Call the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Today, members, we will be examining the Civil Legal Services budget as well as the Public Defender budget. So with that, Mr. Lane, who do we have? Mr. Tracy, I've got different people scheduled here. How many?
Mr. Chairman, my colleague Gary Hurd, the COO of Smalls, was going to be here today, but he was sick and thought it would be a disservice to the committee to share his germ with you, so he's staying home.
We appreciate that.
For the benefit of all of us. So I get to talk twice as much. And Mr. Tracy is here because I am not one of the great techno geeks of our time, and so he will make sure that the slide.
Okay, well, please go ahead and present your material.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members and staff. My name is Jeremy Lane. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, which serves low-income people in 20 counties in central Minnesota and persons with disabilities statewide. I'm here on behalf of the Legal Services Coalition, which represents people in all of your districts in all 87 counties of the state. Thank you for this time and the opportunity to discuss our budget request, and my thanks also for your bipartisan support for legal services over many years. I'll be presenting information today about the civil legal services impact statewide, our role in providing services essential to the operation of the justice system, and the effect our services have on controlling the cost of government. I'll also be discussing our impact on promoting public safety, our value as a tool to help Minnesotans facing economic hardship, and the specifics of what's needed to sustain these services. The justice system is complex and getting more so, especially in these challenging times. It has to move quickly. In order for people to have effective access to the system, it's essential to have an attorney in many cases to guide them through the system, especially when their cases involve critical issues like homelessness, hunger, sickness, abuse. Civil Legal Services works to provide that effective access to our justice system for the 1 out of 6 of your constituents who are near or below the poverty level. Minnesota's funding for Civil Legal Services is distributed by the Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee, which we refer to as LSAC. LSAC distributes funds to 36 legal services programs. Several of those programs are regional programs that provide services to all 87 counties, and those programs are known as the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. In 2007, those 36 legal services programs provided representation in almost 53,000 cases statewide. In addition to direct legal representation, the legal services programs presented community legal education workshops to more than 70,000 low-income Minnesotans to help them understand both their rights and their responsibilities under the law. Legal services programs also support a website that provides a great deal of information and self-help materials available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and which received 650,000 hits last year, up from roughly 400,000 the year before. So this is a very fast-growing piece of the service that we provide to your constituents. The Civil Legal Services programs prioritize the types of cases that are most critical for low-income Minnesotans, cases where our help prevents domestic violence, provides safe, sanitary, and affordable housing, helps students to be successful in school. The case priorities of the Legal Services programs also match the state's priorities of ensuring access to health care, protecting the most vulnerable, and removing barriers to self-sufficiency. According to the 2000 census, over 500,000 Minnesotans have incomes below 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. Approximately another 500,000 have incomes below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, which would be an income of about $44,000 for a family of four. These numbers were collected well before the economic crisis that has been particularly affecting low-wage workers and those trying to enter the workforce. So the number of people eligible for our services is unquestionably higher than it was 2 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. And I'm afraid the growth in our client community is not over. Chief Justice Magnuson has been speaking about the critical work performed by the justice system, and the chief has pointed out that inadequate funding of any one part of the justice system, whether it's the courts, public defenders, the civil legal services programs, affects the efficiency of the whole system. Civil legal services helps low-income Minnesotans navigate the complicated justice system so the courts can efficiently resolve conflicts. In addition, the civil legal services programs help protect the public's confidence in the justice system. While the court's survey of public perception of the justice system shows a generally high level of trust in the system, there is unfortunately one segment of the population that did not provide as favorable a view. Not surprisingly, it's the most underserved population, namely low-income persons and persons of color. They have a more critical view of the justice system because they face barriers to accessing that system. We help provide effective access to the justice system for those populations, increasing their confidence in the system and their belief that the justice system, in fact, serves all Minnesotans fairly. As Minnesota's leaders look for new and innovative ways to save the state money during these difficult times, Minnesota's legal services programs are already working to reduce the costs of the justice system. We are an efficiency mechanism. We annually screen out at least 3,000 cases by explaining to potential litigants their case would not succeed in court, so we keep it out of the system altogether. Or we take cases that have merit and, like most lawyers, settle 90% of them out of court. So those thousands of cases that we either filter out or resolve out of court would be clogging the court system without our services. Any judge will tell you their nightmare is the unrepresented, unsophisticated litigant in their courtroom. We remove this burden from the courts by using out-of-court time to explain procedures and results to clients so they can understand what's happening without taking the time of judges or court personnel. People on both sides of the political aisle have supported legal services because of the benefits we provide to the state. In addition to the work of the staff members of the legal services programs, we also recruit, train, and support hundreds of volunteer attorneys every year serving low-income Minnesotans all over the state, thus further leveraging your investment. Legal services programs help to establish over $4 million a year in new child support awards. This is money that works year after year to help single parents and their children become self-sufficient. The child support either helps keep people off of public assistance or helps reimburse part or almost all of the public assistance they receive. Now that figure of $4 million does not factor in the cumulative benefit that builds year after year over time, and I'll explain that in a minute. Our work helps prevent homelessness and protect families from unlawful foreclosures and predatory lending scams. We keep more than 2,650 individuals and families each year from having to access our already overtaxed shelters, saving state and local communities over $4 million each year. Many of our low-income Minnesotans suffer from some form of mental or physical disability. The process for obtaining Social Security Disability, which is the wage-based federal disability program, or SSI, for those who haven't been able to accumulate an earnings record, it's very complicated and has a lot of procedural pitfalls. Minnesota legal aid programs help hundreds of people navigate these systems and obtain the benefits which they need and for which they qualify. Clients obtain higher levels of household income so they can be self-sufficient. The state is relieved of the burden of providing state-funded benefits. This saves the state in new benefits alone, $5 million a year every year. Now, this is also a benefit that accumulates over years. To give you very specific numbers, and I finished doing the math on this literally last night, we handled 700 successful SSI and RSDI appeals in 2008, and that doesn't include my friends in Northeast Minnesota, because I wasn't able to get the numbers from them yesterday. 700 successful appeals last year. In addition to that, $5 million I mentioned, which is initial back benefits award, because a typical appeal takes between 1 and 2 years, and if you succeed, then you get the client gets a check for the back benefits for the time of application. much of which, by the way, often goes to reimburse the state for general assistance. There's also an ongoing cash benefit to each client. The Social Security Administration states that the average duration of an SSI or RSDI award is 10 years. So cases that we won 7 and 8 and 9 years ago are still producing monthly cash benefit checks to your constituents throughout the state. The benefit level right now is $674 a month, and that sounds like a fairly modest amount, and it is in any one case. I will mention that that is an amount that gets adjusted for inflation every year, so that next year it will be a little bit higher. In the last 5 years, that monthly benefit per client has gone up $110 a month. Okay, we have 700 successful cases a year, and $674 per month per client. Our 2008 clients alone are getting $471,000 per month in cash benefits. That's $5.6 million last year added to our work. Since the annual benefit builds for 10 years, which is the average duration of each SSI award we win, after doing this work for 10 years, and we've been doing it for 30, our work is generating, in 2008, $56.6 million of benefits for our clients, your constituents. And that's on top of that $5 million in new back benefit awards. But that's not all. Successful SSI and RSDI applicants go off state-funded general assistance medical care, or even worse, any uncompensated care in your local hospitals, onto MA, which is 50% federally funded. Conservatively estimating that each SSI recipient gets about $5,000 in medical care a year, and that's a gross underestimate, because by definition we're talking about people who are permanently and totally disabled due to medical problems, so they are probably using at a way higher level. But using that extremely conservative $5,000 a year per client, half of that, which is the federal share, is $2,500 per client per year extended over 10 years. That's $17.5 million after 10 years of work last year alone. So $56.6 million in cash benefits, plus $5 million in new back benefits, plus $17.5 million in medical care, is $79.1 million last year coming into your communities. And all of that is federal money coming into and spent in your communities every year because of legal aid. You all know better than I do that Minnesota sends a lot more money to Washington than we get back. Well, legal aid is one way that you can help improve that imbalance of payments. I don't know how many other state-funded entities can put up those kinds of annual numbers for you. But even that doesn't tell the full story, because you all know also the economic impact of money brought into your communities is multiplied. The most conservative multiplier I've ever seen is 2. I think the reality is closer to 3. But if we use 2, our clients are spending those benefits in your communities at the grocery store, at Home Depot, at the hardware store, at Walmart, at the gas station, at the doctor, at the drugstore, and in all of those places, it helps pay the salaries of the people who work in those establishments. That money is circulated in your community, recirculated at least once. So the economic benefit in your communities is really over $158 million a year, year after year. I mentioned child support a couple of minutes ago, and I'm not going to try to do the math here on the cumulative benefit, but one study estimates that child support orders have a lifespan of about 10 years, which means you have that same building effect for the child support orders we got 5 and 6 and 7 years ago. They're still paying benefits to our clients. Let me just say that while I hope I can give you more detailed numbers next year on child support, I think that legal aid, in addition to being a critical part of the justice system, may be one of the most successful economic development projects funded by the state of Minnesota. Minnesota's legal services programs have, we think, been innovative leaders in promoting efficiency and transforming services will be to maximize services to low-income Minnesotans. And I'd like to give some examples of that because we always operate in an environment of scarcity. I've been doing it for 39 years, and we've never had enough funding. And so we are always looking for ways to squeeze bang for the buck. And to give one example, going back to some of the earlier days, Representative Bigger might be particularly interested in legal services, pioneered the use of paralegals back when I had hair. We recently developed a program called ICANN. It's a marital dissolution document assembly program to be used in self-help kiosks. We developed that program with the help of a legal services corporation there, again, federal money coming in from out of state, so that pro se persons who aren't able to get to either our office or a private attorney's office can prepare a marital dissolution petition without the need for an attorney. We also, with foundation help, have developed an online order for protection petition so that battered women can, with the help of somebody at their domestic abuse shelter, do an online OSP application, again, making the court system and the domestic abuse system more efficient. We have developed regional hotlines to improve rural access to our services. We have consolidated intake systems in my program for multiple offices into one office to reduce staff and improve efficiency. We have developed websites called Pro Justice and Law Help, also with the help of out-of-state grant money. The ProJustice website is for lawyers, staff attorneys, judicare attorneys, and volunteer attorneys. It provides training materials, forms, briefs. For example, the definitive manual on landlord-tenant law, which was developed by one of my staff attorneys over 15 years, is now available at the touch of a button to any staff attorney, judicare lawyer, or volunteer attorney in any one of your districts wanting to represent a low-income client with a landlord-tenant problem, making their work much more efficient and effective. We convinced our colleagues in Washington to make Minnesota the first out of the East Coast state to pilot this system. So all of the startup costs were covered by out-of-state national and foundation funding, and this is a huge resource. Law help is for consumers, both low-income consumers and social services persons, helping those consumers, providing them self-help information on their rights and responsibilities, helping to prevent or resolve problems without the need for an attorney whenever possible. We now have added, with VISTA funding, a position staffing what we call live help, which is someone available in real time at the end of the computer to provide interactive assistance to unsophisticated persons trying to navigate the law help website to find the community legal education materials that they're looking for. SNAILS has developed a regional hotline. We are now working with the Hennepin and Ramsey Bar Association finding resources to train 211 staff to improve the efficiency of their handling of intake calls. They get tens of thousands of calls from people who aren't sure what they need, but many of them are looking for legal help. We have gotten multi-year Bush Foundation grants totaling over $500,000 to upgrade our computer systems to enable us to work more efficiently and to coordinate work among our programs, so that now a staff attorney in Representative Eastman's district and Representative Hawes' district can work simultaneously on pleadings or memos with one of my litigation records in the Minneapolis office of our program in real time, thereby improving the efficiency and quality of the work done in our Cambridge office or our St. Cloud office. We are in the process of identifying and adapting an online client intake system so that a client who may be 50 or 75 miles from the local legal aid office can ask for help online and have their case screened. It also enables people, low-wage workers who have a very hard time getting off of work, they can ask for assistance online at night or on the weekend without taking time off from work and possibly jeopardizing their jobs. With our improved computer capacity, thanks in large part to the Bush Foundation, we've been able to bring in-house administrative and fiscal management functions that we used to have to contract out. And I know in my program alone, we have saved tens of thousands of dollars each year in costs in that area. My program has staff attorneys on site at the Hennepin County Housing Court, which you've heard about from Supreme Court folks at their self-help center, so that court staff can send tenants or low-income landlords up for on-the-spot information and assistance before they walk into the housing court, thereby making the housing court more efficient on the spot. We also have volunteer lawyers who are there with us who could not do that without us, because some of those volunteers are first or second year lawyers, and having one of our 15 or 20 year experts right available in the office next door to them makes it possible for them to provide information to low-income tenants and landlords on the spot. We are working on interactive computer programs that will enable non-English speaking clients to answer questions in their own language and have a computer generate a document for them in English. That's just part of what we do by way of improving efficiency. We promote public safety in important ways. 10 years of Federal Department of Justice statistics were analyzed for the short and long-term impact, trying to figure out why people are or are not abused. And they concluded that access to a legal aid office was one of only two statistically relevant factors reducing the probability of a woman being battered. The impact of that, Representative Tamar knows better than I do, the financial impact on the state of domestic violence, short-term and long-term. Short-term, you have shelter costs, you have the strains on the criminal justice system. Long-term, you have the sad reality that children who grow up with domestic violence learn to use violence to solve their problems as adults, and a disproportionate number of them wind up in the criminal justice system, which is the least efficient, most effective way to deal with the social problem. Homelessness and housing instability are huge risk factors for school failure. A kid who moves three times has half the reading scores of kids who stay in one place. Academic failure leads to truancy, it leads to acting out, leads to juvenile court, leads to adult criminal court. Yesterday, MSNBC had a long article on school districts struggling to deal with the increased number of homeless kids. That article noted that kids dealing with homelessness are 50% less likely to graduate from high school than their peers. Last year, the 14,000 public school districts in this country counted more than 780,000 homeless students. That's up 15% just from the year before. So this is a huge risk factor that legal services addresses directly by reducing homelessness. Legal services is also a tool for economic recovery. We deal with mortgage foreclosure more and more every day. Unfortunately, we haven't seen the worst of it. There's an entire class of adjustable-rate mortgages scheduled to have their interest rates bumping up in 2009. So this problem is not over. It probably hasn't even peaked. Mayors and MNRA's Joint Housing Assistance Project just learned a couple of weeks ago that a $200,000 a year grant we were getting from the Family Housing Fund cannot be renewed because the Family Housing Fund lost over 40% of their funding from the McKnight Foundation, because the McKnight Foundation has been hammered by the economic downturn like everybody else. So that's $200,000 a year of housing assistance that's scheduled to go away at the end of this grant. We resolve housing problems. Mayors has a HOPE program, which has seen a huge increase from 2007 to 2008. The fourth quarter of 2008 saw assistance increasing 60% from the fourth quarter of 2007. We are a tool for economic recovery. We work with credit and household finances. We have debt clinics, which of course at this point have no vacancies and are oversubscribed. We are seeing longer and longer waiting lists for bankruptcy assistance, and the fear is that we're going to be able to provide less of it. Judge Rotenberg noted in Brown County District Court that in economic downturn times, he sees in his court five areas of need going up: evictions, foreclosures, domestic violence, credit problems, and crime. We handle four of those directly, and I think the fifth indirectly. And in addition, what he may not see in his courtroom, dramatic increase in health care access issues, the people who lose their jobs and therefore their health insurance, increases in the first unemployment costs, which are skyrocketing. They don't show up in the district court, they show up in administrative hearing processes where legal aid works. The heart of the problem of cutting legal aid, of course, is that it does not save money. Our clients will not go away if they can't be our clients. They will show up as unrepresentatives in the court, in truancy, in juvenile court, in domestic violence shelters, homeless shelters, public assistance programs, hospital emergency rooms, all of which are more expensive, less efficient ways to address their problems. 4 years ago, the legislature gave us an increase in funding, which restored some, but not all, of the capacity we have lost just since 2001. We had requested a $2 million increase in 2007. The legislature was only able to provide half of that, and at the last minute was not able to include even that $1 million in the base funding. That increase, that $1 million increase, sustained a maintenance of effort on our part. We were not able to restore further lost staffing, and that funding, with no base cut, goes away June 30th, which means we will lose 7% of our state appropriation if you cut the base, not at all. The 5% base cut in the governor's first budget proposal would translate to a 12% cut in terms of our ability to deliver services with state funding. We are also losing funding from foundations, United Ways, private donors, law firms, the state's Interest and Lawyers Trust Accounts program. That program operated by the Supreme Court, which depends on the revenue from clients held in lawyer trust accounts, has seen its revenue go down from $3.8 million a year 2 years ago to $1.6 million this year. So that's almost a 60% reduction in IOLTA revenues. We are facing an economic perfect storm. It has been a benefit to us over the years to have multiple funding sources and not just depend on you. The problem is, when everybody's going down, the impact on us is that much worse. And I will mention, unfortunately, that there is no money earmarked for legal services in the stimulus package. There was an effort in the Senate to put some money earmarked for legal services, but it was a casualty of the last-minute negotiations to reduce the size of the Senate package. We hope that maybe we'll be able to get some money that may be targeted for domestic violence work or some homelessness work, but nothing is promised to us or aimed at us. I know it may seem irrational for us even to use the word increase at the time of this budget crisis in the state, but this is not about us. It's not about me. It's not about the lawyers in my program. It's about the people we're serving. It's about the poorest of your constituents, the people at the bottom of the economic ladder. They are taking the brunt of this economic mess, and they will take the brunt of any cut to legal services. I think when things are at their worst, it is most important for the people at the bottom to have somewhere to turn, for help that may enable them and their families to weather this storm, whether it's temporary unemployment, temporary reliance on public assistance. We can help these people believe that the rule of law isn't just a weapon used against them by landlords and loan companies. It can be a tool to protect them. Our services make society safer. They're a very small piece of the system, but I hope these numbers have convinced you that it's a very large impact and that we can make a huge difference in the lives of people when they're vulnerable, and a huge difference actually in the economic impact on the state of poverty. The only good news about our being a small piece of the system is that enabling us to maintain our very cost-effective services would involve what, in the big picture you face, is a very small investment. But our targeted investment is then targeted entirely at your most vulnerable constituents. Thank you for your time. I'd like to thank our partners in the justice system who have been very supportive of our efforts, and I'd like to thank you all for your support over many years.
Mr. Lane, thank you for your presentation. Just a quick question, and I'll open it up. If there is a 5% reduction that the governor recommends, you state in your PowerPoint presentation that 3,000 low-income clients will lose service. Have you prioritized what area of legal services that you provide will be cut, or how are you going to make that determination if the 5% cut becomes a reality?
Well, the final decision is made by each local program board of directors, which is responsible for priority setting, and so the answer may not be identical. And to use my program as an example, in Minneapolis or St. Cloud or Cambridge or Wilmer, where we have offices, so the answer may be different in, you know, concentrated poverty in urban Minnesota from what it is in Cambridge, but we have been narrowing our priorities for 20 years, Representative Painter. At this point, we don't do anything that isn't a critical legal need: housing, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, and education. What I would anticipate is that there would be cuts probably proportionate throughout our service delivery system in terms of substantive areas, because there isn't anything low priority left to cut. When I started in legal aid, we handled a much broader range of legal work, but at this point, anything that's not a critical need is already being referred out. I would anticipate in my program probably housing, which is already the largest area of service we provide, will continue to be number one. I wouldn't be surprised if family law and domestic violence continue to be number two. Beyond that, my fear is that areas like consumer protection against predatory lending, work for seniors who maybe aren't facing homelessness, reductions in public assistance benefits will go by the wayside. But the bottom line is, we're going to have to do less, even in the areas of housing and domestic violence, if we have to make those kinds of cuts. Otherwise, we'll have to abandon whole areas of the law, and I think that would be very unhealthy, because we are an accountability mechanism. Even if we can't handle a lot of consumer problems, if we can handle some, we can keep people who might be tempted to cut corners in terms of the legality of their practices, try to keep them at least a little bit honest.
And Mr. Lane, have you anticipated how many lawyers would be laid off with a 5% reduction?
We would anticipate losing, I think, between 10 and 15% of 160, so whatever that is, somewhere in the range of 16 to 20. That's a ballpark estimate. It has been intentional on my part to give you numbers that deal with the users of the system, not the providers, because, you know, if I have to lay off an attorney, they're probably going to find a job somewhere. The clients don't have anywhere else to go, and that's why what's important to me is the number of clients who I have to turn away rather than the size of my staff.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you got any... Chief Justice Magnuson has indicated that if the governor's budget recommendations were to be enacted into law, that the courts would stop providing a number of services that they're currently providing. Many of those services are the types of things that you're talking about, legal aid, civil legal services providing to clients. Have you done any estimates or taken a look at Chief Justice Magnuson's hit list or list of things that would the courts would stop providing, and how that might impact the need for services through your organization?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, of the calls, you live in fear for what might happen. I think the court probably will not be able to stop doing, for example, evictions, which would be number one on my list of things that need to be done. It's in the nature of, at least from some people's perception, an emergency service that the courts provide and have to be able to provide on fairly short notice. Obviously, because we operate entirely on the civil side of the street, anything the courts do that impacts on the criminal justice side would not directly impact us. Although the unfortunate reality is that some of our clients are crime victims, and therefore some of our clients would have the feeling that they're not able to get justice through the criminal justice system if the courts have to shut down. we have been focused with the Chief Justice and our friends in the public defense system and the county attorneys on trying to prevent the damage that the Chief has laid out. If that happens, you can be sure that we will be meeting with the Chief and with the Judicial Council to try to convince them that the areas that are most critical to the safety and health of low-income people kind of far down the list of what they stop doing as we can push it. That's the best we can do.
That's cool.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I sounds like you haven't put pencil to paper yet, and I understand that. I appreciate that's fine. I guess the next question I would have, though, and I apologize, I walked in about 5 minutes late. If you covered this, I apologize. When your attorneys are able to establish either an increase in benefits or prevent a proposed decrease in benefits, something where your clients are obtaining some kind of a financial benefit, are there any efforts to collect either on a sliding scale or some type of revenue for the services that are being provided? Is there participant participation, if you will, in the cost of providing the services?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, we encourage donations for our clients, and some astonishingly poor clients do that. The federally funded legal services programs are not permitted to charge fees to their clients. The reality is, if we use two examples, the SSI benefits that I talked about earlier, $674 a month. The average cost of an apartment is $600 a month or more. So these people, if we ask them for some sort of a sliding fee out of those benefits, that's going to be coming out of the money they would otherwise be spending on food or clothing. They don't have discretionary income. I'm sure many of you saw the article in the Star Tribune the other day about the fact that the standard of living for the TANF program in Minnesota hasn't gone up in 22 years. So the full benefit, the full cash benefit, isn't remotely enough to pay for an apartment, let alone a lawyer's fee. So it's the people we are serving, any money they give us is coming out of the true essentials, which is food, clothing, medical care. And so it has somewhere between no and very little potential. It humbles me when clients do respond to that contribution request, because I know it's coming out of money they shouldn't be sending to us. But some of our funders encourage us to at least ask, and so we do that.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lane. I guess I'd just like to say that I appreciate the area of law that you work in, and it's important. It's important in my community, and I think it's something that we need to really think long and hard about how we continue to make available. But my questioning kind of goes a little bit in the same direction as Representative Coles. On page 6 of our little handout here, there's a slide. It talks about leveraging the funds, and it says one-third of the money comes from that supports your organization comes from the state, one-third from the federal government, and one-third from private sources. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and how they relate to each other, and particularly, I'm interested in what the private sources are and how they affect your work.
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, thank you for asking. Federal funding started way back over 30 years ago. It peaked in terms of purchasing power in 1980. It has, in terms of purchasing power, been going down steadily ever since, so that at this point, the federal funding that we get from the Legal Services Corporation has 48% of the service delivery power that it had in 1980, which means we've taken an effective federal hit of over half of our ability to deliver services. But that money, the primary source of that money is the Federal Legal Services Corporation. It's a congressional appropriation. I think it's been 5 years since there's been any restoration of any of that funding. We have some hope that the 2009 final appropriation may include a little bit of a restoration, but the best case scenario, from what we've been told from Washington, is that if there is any restoration of some of that lost funding, it will be significantly less than the funding we know we're going to be losing in the June IOTA grant cycle. We've been told by the Murray Trust Account Board, which distributes IOTA funding, that they're giving out at least $500,000 less in grants this year. And the best case scenario from Washington is that they might spend about $350,000. So we're net losing just from those two funds alone. On the local and private level, we get United Way funds, which I've mentioned. My program has been a United Way agency for, since the United Way was founded, 70, 80 years ago. The United Way is being forced by economic reality to narrow their priorities. I received word a few months ago that a program we have serving youth is not going to be eligible for funding from the United Way because they narrowed the priorities for their service for children to the extent that the service we provide for older children is simply not going to be eligible for funding. It's not any dissatisfaction with what we do or how well we do it. They just are being forced, again, to narrow and narrow, and so we're losing $100,000 a year from the United Way, not because we did anything wrong, but because they don't have the funds to keep doing what they've been doing. We have our hands as deep in the pocket of the private sector lawyers as we can get them. I'm pleased to report that in my program area alone, we get over $1 million a year from the private lawyers. That's from big firms, small firms, solo practitioners. And I have to tell you that one of the ways we do it is by making sure that they understand when I come here, the first question I get, and it was the third question today, but it's one of the first questions I've gotten every year, is what are the private lawyers doing? And they, like you, like being part of a multi-legged stool funding legal aid. So they're digging into their pockets, and I have to say that the closest thing to a bright spot I've got in my life right now is that funding, with a couple of exceptions, you know, you had one of the big firms in town laid off 30 of their lawyers, no one's laying off 15. So lawyers are hurting, the law firms are hurting. They are so far, with very few exceptions, not cutting their annual grant to us, which I think is a tribute to their judgment of the value of what we're doing. Some are. A couple of firms have even increased their donations a little bit, but, you know, to get even if it's a 1 or 2% increase at a time when those firms are cutting back. And one of the firms that gave us a slight increase is one of the firms that's laying off their own staff and associates. So I think they are stepping up. I have said, and they believe, that while they can't be the whole solution any more than groceries should be the only ones feeding poor people, or doctors at their own expense providing medical care, they're gatekeepers of justice, and they should be leaders. And I think in this state they are leaders, and they're doing per capita and proportionally better than almost any state in the country in terms of putting their money on the table in addition to their time. Private lawyers are putting over $10 million a year of time on the table, and of course we want their money and their lives, and we ask for it, and we're getting it.
Thank you, Mr. Lane, for your presentation. And we have to move on to the public defender budget.
Just one quick follow-up. I guess along with Cole's line of questioning, obviously a sliding fee or some kind of a contribution by the client in my view, it's an important piece just in principle. I mean, maybe it's just $10, but it seems like at some point you get to the point of eligibility where you've got somebody who is eligible or not eligible, and there's kind of a line there, and all of a sudden somebody's paying the surf rate if they're not eligible, and they're paying nothing if they are eligible. And I guess I just think that's something that we should look at and try and come up with a little clearer picture of how we could do this in a way that at least lets people participate and encourages them to participate a little bit. I mean, not with the thought of recovering all the costs, but with the thought of I think it's always more meaningful if somebody has a little skin in the game. So.
Mr. Lane, if you can just respond in like 30 seconds.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we, Representative Eastman, we have explored that and we continue to look for ways. I know SNAIL, for example, provides some assistance to low-income farmers, and they require, I think, a $50 copay. In that category of cases where people may not be in quite the same level of desperation, which I think is a fair word to use, for somebody living on TANF or somebody trying to survive on an SSI grant award or a senior citizen living on Social Security. My board for several years tried, at least asking for, a $10 component from people if they're not below 100% of the poverty line, because the people who are below that line are really at risk of not being able to eat properly or go to the doctor. And the board was hesitant to have those people thinking that their inability to send anything would be a barrier to their coming to us for services. That did not raise enough money to be worth the accounting time to track and deposit an account for the funds. We will continue to explore it. The problem we're facing is that our clients, the overwhelming majority of our clients, are well below 100% of the poverty line, where I think asking them to send us money means it's coming out of rent or food.
Thank you, Mr. Lane, for your presentation. I appreciate it. We may have you back, but thank you very much. If you could come up while they're coming up, I need a motion to approve the minutes of February 26, 2009.
Mr. Chair, I need the approval of the minutes for that meeting.
Moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions or suggestions or any omissions in those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Mr. Kyer and Mr. Ward, right?
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. To my right is Bill Ward, the Chief Public Defender of the 10th Judicial District, which is the Anoka, Washington, Chisago County area. First of all, Chairman, I wanted to thank you and the committee for the past support that you've provided for public defense. As you know, we're facing a very critical time, which would be much worse if it weren't for the support that we got from all of you over the last couple of years. Secondly is we do not envy your position and where you're at. You will have to be making some very difficult decisions along with your colleagues over the next several months. And again, I don't envy you or any of the rest of the members of this body or the Senate, because there are going to be some difficult choices. Having said that, I hope you all understand too is that we have a job to do, and one of our jobs is to present to you all the needs and what's going on out there in terms of our clients and in terms of our staff. And as Jerry Lane mentioned, it is kind of odd to be sitting here talking about increases at the same time that in another few hours you all are going to be getting a revenue forecast that's probably not going to look very good and probably much worse than the one you all got in December. But again, that's part of our job, part of our mission. So, Chairman, with your permission, I guess we talk a little bit about the background here. Most of you are on the policy committee, so you had some of that, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. Talk a little bit about the governor's budget and the impacts of that, and then the budget request, and then follow up with some of the things that we've been trying to do, at least on the non-personnel side, to do things a little better. Some of these are ongoing initiatives that we've been doing for a while. Some of them, frankly, are the result of some of the budget difficulties we've been facing. And we know you've got some time constraints, so we'll try to leave as much time for questions as we can.
We have time. Mr. Kaiser, are you going to walk us through the budget book? How are you going to present this?
Mr. Chairman and members, you have a handout that was in your packet from last week entitled State of Minnesota Board of Public Defense, Health, Public Safety, Finance.
Right, okay.
So I'll start with that. I think also in there were two news articles, one of which references a case here in St. Paul that was an interesting case on a delay situation. The other one was a day in the life of a public defender, and I want to reference a little bit of that, not because of so much what it says about public defenders, but kind of what it says about the folks that we deal with, and frankly the folks that Civil Legal Services also are dealing with. So, Mr. Chairman and members, several years ago, when we first went through a budget issue with the board, our board set out a set of priorities and services, and it kind of gets to what some of the questions are that I heard from the folks in the court and Civil Legal Services. But the budget principles that the board set out were to minimize negative impacts on clients, maintain a statewide public defender system, minimize impacts on staff and infrastructure, and place a priority on mandated services. The top priority in terms of our service delivery, and I know that question came up previously, is to prioritize the service to in-custody clients. Those are the folks that are facing the most serious crimes. Those are the folks that are facing the most loss of liberty. And frankly, from a system standpoint, are probably the most important. If you talk to the counties, one of their big issues, obviously, is jail space and having folks sitting in those county jails the longest. Secondly, the evaluation of staff in the specialty courts and the representation in non-mandatory cases, which both of which we've talked about at the policy committee, and I think have been kind of well publicized. The board is the largest user of the court system, provides service in every county and every courtroom. It is really kind of the quality control of the justice system. We have had a number of chiefs of police, you have had prosecutors here talk about how much better their job is, how much more efficient they are when we have an effective public defender system, and effective public defenders who are able to move those cases through the process. Our cases and workloads or time commitments are all controlled by outside factors. Again, that's something that you all hear. I know you heard it from the Commissioner of Corrections. You heard it from the courts. But it really is true. We don't control that caseload. We have to take, our lawyers have to represent all the cases that they are assigned to, and that's by Supreme Court case law. For this year, Mr. Chairman, we are looking at 165,000 to 170,000 cases. We talked about in the policy committee. We represent the vast majority of the cases that come through the criminal justice system. I think you all probably saw the article in the Minneapolis Tribune over the weekend in the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. Again, a huge majority of those cases that come through that system and, frankly, through the statewide system are public defender cases. Currently, our staff is working right now with about 750 case units per lawyer. That is roughly twice the recommended, not quite the twice the recommended standard. Frankly, that is, I think, a little low. If you can imagine, we have about half of our folks are part-time. And if you are a part-time defender and you are putting in all of the hours that those folks do, I think the last thing on your mind when you finish the day is, well, I'm going to fill out my case opening, case closing forms and my time reporting forms. It's just not a priority for them. And we've worked very hard with them to make it a priority for them, but again, there are only so many hours in the day. So we think that probably is actually underreported. It also tends not to take into account the work on individual cases or on caseloads. If you look at page 7 of that handout, again, about half of our staff is part-time. And they take whatever cases come down to them, whatever calendars they're covering. And they're paid on a lump sum basis. Last year, they put in about 44,000 uncompensated hours, and roughly the equivalent of 24 full-time equivalents. I don't mention that from the standpoint because you all sitting around this table put in an awful lot of uncompensated hours, and you all put in a lot of very underpaid hours when you're actually here also, or when you're out in the district. But what it does is give you kind of a magnitude of what some of those folks are dealing with out there. That if in fact we had to hire those folks, or if in fact there was that hourly limit on their time, you'd be looking at an additional 24 lawyers just to get the work done that's being done right now. They do it because they enjoy it. They do it because they're dedicated. They do it because they feel there's an obligation to, that they need to do. When we start talking about people putting in 50 or 70 hours a month extra, you know, they kind of do it. Now we're starting to inch up towards that 100-hour mark. So now you're starting to talk about people putting in an entire month, for example, of uncompensated time. And so we're finding more and more difficult to attract part-time defenders out in greater Minnesota in particular. People are just not willing to make that kind of an unlimited commitment, if you will. As I mentioned, the workloads and the time commitments are really controlled by outside factors. You know, things that you all do here. From 1987 to 2005, there were 86 sentencing enhancements. We've added 26 new judgeships between 1998 and 2008. On July 1st of this year, there are going to be 288 district court judgeships out there. Those are 288 calendars that no matter how many public defenders we have, we're still going to have to cover. The Hennepin County Sheriff was awarded $500,000 in a federal grant for DNA testing to reduce their backlog of cold cases. All of these things, we're not arguing, are not good things. But they give you an idea of how they impact the system. The federal stimulus package, it's our understanding right now that there's $3 billion for law enforcement in that package. And how much of that ends up coming to Minnesota, I don't know. But again, it's one of those issues that, again, impacts the entire system. Not only public defense, but if you've got $3 billion out there in additional police staff, it's going to impact the prosecutors as well. Because there are going to be more cases that those folks are going to have to deal with. If I heard right, and I don't know if I didn't, maybe somebody could help me. When the folks were in the other day talking about the from Target, and they were talking about the shoplifting, it sounded to me, if I heard it right, that Target actually has two forensic labs, which was amazing to me that they were actually private labs, if I heard that correctly. But again, that's one of those resources that we have to deal with. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we are struggling right now. As most of you know, we lost about 50% of our staff last, or I shouldn't say 50%, 12%, 50 full-time equivalent lawyers this spring, about 12% of our staff. We are looking at, if the governor's budget recommendations go through, that there will be an additional 50 lawyers, maybe up to 60 that we would have to let go through some means. So again, another 14% of the staff. In terms of the impacts of that, you know, we've already talked quite a bit about the priorities, about setting the priority of being in custody clients. Our misdemeanor cases right now, I think, are setting out anywhere from 6 to 8 months for resolution right now. So there are a number of those impacts that are starting to be felt already, even without any further reductions. Chairman, at this point, I guess I would like to turn it over to Mr. Ward and just talk a little bit about kind of the impacts of kind of what's going on. The governor's budget recommendation is on page 14 of the handout, and have him just talk a little bit about kind of what's going on the ground, if you will, right now, and kind of the impacts of that recommendation.
Very good. Mr. Ward, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is William Ward. I'm the Chief Public Defender of the 10th Judicial District in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, I heard Chief Justice Magnuson referenced earlier today, and I figured I would do the same thing. He's talked to all of us who would listen and all who would hear that justice is not an option. And I would like to add to that by telling you that really justice is a process and it's not a result. And further, that justice really isn't a spectator sport. I came here, and I've talked to a lot of you in the past, I came here 8 years ago with the idea of coming into a system that was well-regarded by other jurisdictions in the United States about how effective, well-trained, and comprehensive we were. And I told many of you that it was that system and has been that system, and we are no longer that system. We have worked as an agency under the radar for years, doing the best we can, and the work we've done, all of us should be proud of over the years. But we're not doing it anymore. We're not the people that we used to be, and the body that you have been funding isn't effective the way it used to be. The issue really isn't, again, as to whether or not we should be funded. It's a constitutional mandate to fund lawyers for the indigent accused, and I know all of you understand that. The question is what the funding has done and what we've done with it. This body has recognized the importance of what we do. You funded us. You increased our funding at the last biennium. But due to other increases that we had to pay into, and we had to ultimately cut the lawyer staff. Mr. Kyer talked about how statewide it was 12%. For the 10th district, my district, it was 19%. The 10th district is one of the fastest growing bodies in the state. The population grew over 50% from 1990. Coming with that is increased case filing, and ultimately our agency had to increase with its personnel. 19% of the lawyer staff in my district is over 21,000 attorney hours that I cannot make up for this past fiscal year. 21,000 hours that were short. What that means is, in our system, is that everybody is waiting for us. I know the judges have talked to you, you've talked to the respective judges in your district, but it's beyond the old days where we have to wait a few minutes for the public defender. They're waiting for a half of a calendar, or a day, or a week, because we're double and triple booked throughout the system. It used to be in my agency, depending on which county you were, that you'd be double or booked within the county. Now, because of the staffing shortages, we're double and triple booked in different counties. For example, Wright County, which has six judges chambered there, I used to have four part-time lawyers covering conflict cases. I'm now down to one. One lawyer, conflict cases for a six-chambered county. What that means is I have to get lawyers from Sherburne and Anoka and Isanti County to go down there and cover the conflict cases. And it's not as if there's one or two of these things. There's a lot of conflict cases, multiple defending cases where they need and are entitled to separate counsel to represent them. When I was given my budget, in order to make up for the cuts to my budget, I had to rearrange the staff. And what I have is a flow chart like most of you have seen before. And I've changed that chart 26 times over the past 8 months. Just to try and make ends meet, shifting lawyers from county to county, taking them from the juvenile arena to doing adult felony. And what happens when you do that, obviously, at the trial level, is it really interrupts the system. You're taking lawyers from one place to another and asking to cover cases where people's freedoms and lives, frankly, are at stake. And what occurs when we do that, obviously, is delay. And delay and more delays so the lawyers can get up to speed to do the best they can on behalf of their clients. And we're kind of mandated to do that. I mean, we're supposed to be effective lawyers. And I insist that we don't practice on the poor in our agency. So our lawyers have to get up to speed. When that happens, the victims wait to get their day in court. Witnesses are lost. The prosecution gets befuddled, obviously, because we're not prepared. But it's something that has to occur in order for us to do the best we can for our clients. With the shifts and changes I've made, at this point, literally, and I'm not complaining about this, we're literally 2-to-1 prosecution to defense. The counties have recognized the need to have the prosecutors. They cover civil, and they have 100% of the cases. But we have 80-90% of the cases, and I'm outdone 2-to-1 in our agency representing our clients. That leads to backlog. Cambridge yesterday, on the trial calendar, Representative Beeson, you've been there many a time, okay? We had every lawyer that was there had 5 to 8 jury trials that they were expected to be prepared for. 5 to 8 folks that they were expected to be prepared for trial yesterday in court. Some of those were continued to today, some were continued to Monday. That's pretty egregious when you think about it. In private practice, there's not a single lawyer that would be expected to be prepared for 5 to 8 cases, and in the civil bar, that would never, ever happen. Yet we do it to the poor, literally every calendar call in Cambridge and other places in the state. yesterday in Anoka, just to show you what's going to happen even further. One of my lawyers was in a hearing, and I was representing him there, standing by his side. He's one of the best lawyers in my agency. Honestly, he is. And what happened was, he messed up at the trial level. It went to the appellate division, and ultimately a post-conviction was filed in Anoka County. And the basis for the post-conviction, the filing, was ineffective assistance of counsel against one of my finest lawyers. So now the costs involved, as you can imagine, are mounting. Now at the appellate level, it's coming back to the trial court. And what the lawyer did is what we're seeing more and more is he made an egregious mistake. He forgot to tell the client what the ultimate maximum penalty could be. He was so busy covering his other cases that were set for trial, when he told the client what the expectation was, he told him it was a guideline sentence. The offer on a serious felony is 104 months, which is the bottom end of the box of the guidelines, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. The maximum he was told, and he told his client, was 144 months. He said, hey, 104 to 144, you might as well take your chances. The client did. He went to trial. He lost. He was sentenced to over 300 months in prison. That's a mistake that we made, and this guy may never get out of prison because of our mistake. Okay? I can't give that guy his life back. Now we're at the appellate division begging them to bring it back because of a mistake that my lawyer made, and ultimately it's my responsibility. I'm the appointing authority. And the reason the mistake is made is because there's too many cases, too many fingers in the dike, and I will take the responsibility for the mistake. But it's costing all of us as taxpayers, and it's costing the court system more because these mistakes are likely to happen more and more. But for the reason you used to do appellate work, you know these things happen. The effective assistance of counsel issues come up. They're coming up more and more. And just as we can't refuse cases, as the Supreme Court has told us, we're bound by the same ethical responsibilities as a lawyer who has 10 cases a year, let alone 800 cases a year. Mr. Tyer talks about the cut 12% to the state. We're at around 750 units per lawyer. I'm over 800, folks. 800 cases. It's from 800 misdemeanors a year that my folks are being responsible for. Mistakes are going to be made. It's going to cost us. Another example, what's happening to us, is when we are asked to be prepared for these 5 to 7 trials on a jury-given calendar call, and there's these serious cases, because of our lack of staff, we are expected to be up and running on every single day up until that jury trial calendar. On the more serious cases, and you would want this as a taxpayer, some prosecutors can take the entire month off to prepare for these cases. I mean, that's a luxury, obviously, but there's no surprise it does happen, and it happened in Washington County in November on a murder case. Okay, so the lawyer for the prosecution took a month off to prepare for this murder case. My folks were busy working up till the Fridays before the trial. Here's another thing that's happened in our district in Washington County. One of the things I think is a wonderful idea. One judge, one family court. The idea is that the courts would be cognizant of family issues, what's happening in their system. It's somewhat of a new idea throughout the United States, and it's been implemented in Washington County. So we have 10 judges there. We have 10 family courts. Mm-hmm. I have the equivalent of 2.5 lawyers to cover those things.
Mr. Gordon, can you please finish up?
Certainly.
So we have some time for some dialogue here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In March of this, in 2 weeks, I have 2 lawyers on trial on a termination parental rights case, 1 lawyer on a much-needed vacation. I don't have any staff to cover the juvenile calendars for an entire week in Washington County. These are examples that are real-life members. These are happening every day in the 10th. They're happening every day in the state. That's with the increase that you gave us last time. I can't imagine in my district what's going to happen if the governor's budget cuts go into effect.
Thank you, Mr. Ward, for your presentation. Appreciate it. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the questions, Mr. Ward, I just want to get a feel for what you're referring to as cuts, because I'm not even against you on this one. The Wright County, where you said there's only one lawyer left in conflicts, that was earlier in your testimony. Were the others just not positions that weren't filled or actual cuts?
They were either... Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, they were either laid off or I had to transfer them to other counties where the layoff occurred.
Okay. And Representative Olin, and those obviously occurred because of the cuts that were happening before, right?
Mr. Ward. Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually not going to respond to your comment about that the attorneys get to take months off to prepare for one trial. I work for a county attorney, and for every 10 years in a courtroom, there's a county attorney there, too. So my question has to do with some states have a flat rate fee for private or for public defenders. So like for a misdemeanor, you know, it's a fee. For a gross misdemeanor, it's a fee. For felony, it's a fee. Just wondering, has there been any consideration or discussion about changing, I guess, or doing the sliding scale? I guess talking, you know, kind of going off what Representative Eastman or Representative Colt has mentioned earlier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bigham, the legislature did pass a fee scale back in 2005. 2003, which was declared unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court. So we do have a $28 copayment, which is waivable, which, you know, clients pay. There are also, as we mentioned in the policy committee, there is reimbursement that's paid, again, or may be paid, where a court deems that somebody can afford to. But a strict fee where there is no option to waive is unconstitutional.
Mr. Cryer or Mr. Ward, I'm looking at two pages in the budget book. I don't know if you have them, but I'm looking at page 7 of the budget book that, and if you look numbers, these two stuck out for me. Program at a glance and the sex offender notification hearings that you represent clients jumped. When I looked at the budget book from the last biennium, it was 487. Now that's jumped to 709. I'm wondering why the increase. And I'm also wondering what, is this a statutory requirement that public defenders represent sex offenders at community notification hearings? I've been to them. I don't remember seeing a public defender there. I'm just wondering why you do that. And do other states represent clients at community notification hearings?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you look on page 12 of the handout that we have, we represent, or our lawyers in the appellate division represent folks at the end of confinement review hearings and then also the end of confinement review appeals. And you can see both of those areas have increased dramatically. And again, it's a function of how many folks are being committed. And I think those of you who deal with your county attorneys understand that that's a huge issue.
The question I asked. I understand that, and I see the need for that. I'm asking about maybe I'm just misunderstanding the terminology. The community notification hearings, where there's, I'm assuming those are sex offenders who are being released into our communities, and everyone has to get.
Those are the ratings of the individual. It's very category 1, 2, or 3. That's where we represent them. We don't represent somebody at the community hearing where I think what you're thinking of, which is where they notify the neighbors of somebody going to be sex offender moving into the neighborhood. You know, there's no representation there.
And why would that be? Why would, Mr. Carter, do you know why that's in the budget book? Or is that just in my... That's not what it says in our book. So maybe we need to clarify
Mr. Chairman, the title is actually the community notification or community entry hearings. Maybe a misprint or a
defender notification.
Right.
Is what it's called.
Right.
In the book.
Yeah.
So that
and that is
on.
That is where the determination of a level 1, 2, or 3 sex offender is done. That's what that is referencing.
The other part that stuck out to me is on page 8 of the budget book, where if you look at that graph, members, you'll see like it seems like an enormous amount of cases on parole revocation. I guess my first question will be why is that number so high? And is this also something that public defenders do in other states?
Mr. Chairman, members, you have many more people out on parole. If you look again on page on the handout,
page, I believe it's 12, you can see, page 13, you can see the growth in the number of folks that have been committed to the as inmates to our correctional facilities. Those folks are now starting to go out on parole. So you have more folks out, you have more folks that violate. You have more parole officers, you have more folks that end up getting violated.
Yes.
And so they are then entitled to representation, and our appellate office does do that work.
Do the other states provide public defender services?
Mr. Stewart said he might be able to answer that for you.
Mr. Stewart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. Mr. Chair, the right to a lawyer at a parole revocation is a constitutional right that was established about 30 years ago in a U.S. Supreme Court case called Gagnon v. Scarpelli, because the person is losing their liberty. In other words, they were out in the community and they're being put back in prison, and therefore they're entitled to counsel according to the U.S. Supreme Court. So every state has to represent people in parole revocation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, was Mr. Gagnon
here with us at the point?
Was Mr. Gagnon or Mr. Scarpelli the offender in that case? I'm guessing it's Scarpelli, but
Mr. Chair, I see this as a zone where I shouldn't go. I don't know who is who in that case, but I do know that it's a constitutional right and it's enforced in every state.
Mr. Stewart, as long as you're there, I have one more question before I go. There's other members. Last year, you said that you laid off 52 public defenders. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was 53. There were 50 from the trial courts. There were 3 from the appellate office. Not all of those were outright layoffs. Some of them were early retirements that went unfilled, or people that took unpaid leaves. The gist of it was that we lost 53 positions.
Where did the 75 number that you had said out publicly, where did that number come from? Because I heard an interview with you on public radio that said 75 attorneys were. Did I just hear that wrong?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we ever had the prospect of 75 lawyers last year. At the time when the governor's recommendation for this year was vacillating between 5 and 10%, that was in the zone that could be at risk this year.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a series of questions that I'm not
going to. We only have 10 minutes. So
well, they're going to be quick.
Okay.
First off, and just a comment, Mr. Stewart is right. Under a parole hearing rule, since you would be conceivably locking somebody up, yes, there certainly is a reason to have an attorney around on that. I would agree in that position. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowen.
The other questions I've got, and I'm going to do with you a quick math, and I'm not going to try to drag this out, but I was a little amazed to hear one attorney could spend a month handling a case, because I've had a And I know you said 5 to 7 felony cases. I had 19 felony cases where the judge told me I better be ready the next day on all 19. So I would have loved to only be seeing 5 to 7. I've seen a lot higher numbers than that as a prosecutor. Plus, at the same time, I'm going to throw this out there. The county board needed my advice on a serious matter that was involving the county. So in the middle of all this 19 cases that we were going through, I had to ask the judge for at least enough time to run downstairs and deal with my county board, which is also another responsibility of the county attorney. So, but on a serious note, when we talk about the one thing in your reports that does bother me, and I'm not going to ask you a series of questions on it, and you were kind enough not to refer to it today, is that 2-to-1 number, because that really disturbs me. And I'm just going to make a comment and you can answer if you want. But as a county attorney, you have to handle civil advice, advising the county board. You have to handle all types of mental illness and DWI commitments, tax court hearings, child support collections. And oh, by the way, Pennington County has a very good diversion program on juveniles, and we have some on some felonies. But that's just a few examples of things that I know county attorneys have to do. Do you have to match the civil advice or the commitments or any of those areas?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, we don't do the civil work that the county attorneys do. I believe that the comparison was based on the criminal assistant county attorneys and the juvenile court assistant county attorneys. I understand the civil thing is a big responsibility. I used to work for the Wright County attorney on their civil cases, and I know that is a major responsibility, and I don't think that was counted.
I guess mine is more a rural issue anyway. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. Mine's probably more a rural issue in the first place, because us small county attorneys up north don't have the alternative of separating civil and criminal. You better know them all.
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, and I just spoke to Mr. Kay about it, but and he could follow up with me later just for the sake of time, but I was informed that I was talking about the states when I had my previous question about the fees. I was talking about for the public defender's reimbursement rate. Instead of giving them an appropriation, can't we just say just a lump sum, can't we say for every misdemeanor case you get $1,200, you know, reimbursed for doing the case? And that's what I was talking about. And staff informed me that that was not the fact that was ruled unconstitutional. So I was wondering, I know there are, you know, I don't know about a lot, but I know that there are quite a few states that do allow for a fee-based reimbursement on cases. And I was just wondering what your opinion is on that, and you can follow up with me after to talk more in detail about it. But
do you want to put this
Mr. Chairman, I guess, you know, I know we're running out of time. I'm happy to follow up with Representative Bigham on that issue, because there are some states that do that, but they've run into some difficulty with it, and it may be a little bit more than we can get into in the last 5 or 6 minutes here.
Quick question. Let's just assume the worst case scenario, or maybe not even the worst, the best case, this the medium level scenario, that there's 5% reduction. What will that actually mean in terms of reductions in FTEs? Actual positions, because in the last biennium, we didn't lose 52 actual. Some took the, as Mr. Stewart says, some took a sort of a buyout of their. So how many actual positions will we lose?
Mr. Chairman, to clarify, we did in fact lose 53 full-time equivalent lawyers back this spring. Some of them went by salary savings leave. Some of them went by an early retirement center we offered. Some of them went by a voluntary separation program that we offered. Some of them were laid off. But those were 53 full-time equivalent. I think it was actually 65 people that are not working for us today, that were working for us back in June.
And
so,
a 5% cut now?
A 5% will mean an additional 50 staff people at a minimum. That's what we're looking at right now.
And Mr. Stewart, and then Mr. Nicholson has a question. And this is salary negotiations haven't started yet with the public defense.
Right.
What if the public defense board agreed to a freeze on salary increases?
Mr. Chairman, would that result
in 50 more losses?
Those 50 assume that there are no salary increases over the next two-year period. No cost of living adjustments and no step increases.
Very good. Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kier, there were 53 lawyers that were lost in the last biennium. How many of those lawyers were doing parent representation? Because you are no longer doing the CHIPS for parents.
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilston, our lawyers do a variety of things. So, for example, the folks that Mr. Ward lost, when he said he lost 19%, a lot of that was because we took into account that we would not be doing representation of parents anymore. I can't give you the exact number of how many of those folks were representing parents and child protection cases. It's fair to say quite a few of them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that when we're talking about a cut, when you also talk about a cut of a section that you're not going to represent anymore, if you stop doing something and you lose the lawyer right. that were doing it, you're kind of a wash. And so I'm trying to get a sense of,
right.
you know, did 20% of those lawyers that were laid off represent parents? So if you could take a look and give me a sense of that. But you did stop doing a section of work, and we want to know which lawyers were as a result of that.
Mr. Chairman, we lost about 12% of our lawyer staff. The CHIPS representation, the parent representation, is about 9% of the overall caseload. But as we've indicated in the past, that caseload is going up. So but we'll find out.
Thank you.
Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard from the drug court people the other day. I'm just wondering, is representation in drug court mandated, or what effect may this have on the drug court system as well?
Mr. Chair, members, we stopped attending. We don't have the time or the bodies to attend. It's not mandated. Some of those lawyers and some of the districts are doing it basically volunteer work after hours. But other than that, as an agency, we stopped attending the drug court.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kider, I'm wondering kind of along the same lines that we've been asking about here, what's the effect of the court's payables list on the public defender time?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, it has the potential to at least stem the growth. In the misdemeanor, if you look on the chart on page 5 of the handout, of the workload, when you weight the cases, you put 24% of our workload is misdemeanors. So it does have some impact, but the more serious cases, if you will, or the more important ones, even in the misdemeanor area, the DWIs, the domestics, obviously those are not going to be made payable. So a big chunk of those will continue as misdemeanor cases.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, I guess I, along the same lines as the question by Representative Filstrom, I guess I'd like it if you could try to give us, maybe not right now, but a little better estimate of what that impact will be. And also, I'm not remembering the figures right now, but when we had the courts here, maybe you were here at the time, and they showed us their pie chart of how much of their resources go into the minor, into the misdemeanors versus the serious felonies, and I'm not sure if they broke it out the same way you are here. I don't recall if the gross misdemeanors were in lumped in with the serious cases or not. I kind of don't think so, though. And it seemed to me that they had more of their resources on the more minor case side, and I maybe that's neither here nor there, but if you could give us the try to give us a better estimate of how much attorney time will be saved by the changes that they've already made, that would be helpful.
And Mr. Ward, you had said that you're not in your judicial district, you're not going to any of the how many drug courts do you have in your judicial district?
Mr. Chair, members, we just had the one that Judge Rancourt testified to about the other day.
And so there's, Mr. Kier, there's 33 drug courts in the state. Are public defenders not attending those other drug courts?
Mr. Chairman and members, we are not attending drug court where there are post-adjudication drug courts. If it's pre-adjudication, I believe that we are still attending those. The post-adjudication is treated more like a probation violation, which means we're not there, but if somebody ends up violating, they will then come back on a probation violation, which we would then pick up, you know, after that.
Any other questions? Mr. Ward, do you have closing remarks?
Mr. Chairman, I just have one thing. I would encourage all of you to take a look at this article, A Day in the Life of a Public Defender. And I don't, because of what it says about public defenders, I would encourage you to take a look at it for what it says about the people that public defenders are representing. There are six or seven cases in here that folks with this particular defender was dealing with. Every one of them dealt with drug issues. Every one of them dealt, or just about everyone dealt with mental health issues. And just the last thing is, this particular public defender in this day got up at the crack of dawn, left at 8 o'clock, and I just want to read you the last two lines here. I didn't make any special demands on the prosecutor or the judge. I didn't contest anything, and with the exception of Charlie, one of the clients, I didn't spend more than a half an hour on any given client. Still, I had worked a full day, and when I left the office just before 8 p.m., I was spent. That really kind of sums up what's going on out there. And it will get worse. I guess it's just kind of what I'd like to leave you with. So
Mr. Kyle, you'll be down 100 lawyers, if I understand you correctly, if we approve the governor's budget.
Yep.
That's correct. That's on the record.
Yes.
Very good. Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you, for
Thank
your presentation.
You.
Meeting's adjourned.